Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. Today's Thursday, May 19th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, national editor at Politico. Here's where we are. Bernie Sanders supporters are aggravated. The Democratic crackup is threatening to really hurt Hillary Clinton as she's trying to focus on Donald Trump. Facebook has an optics problem with conservative voters in America who are accusing the social network of favoring liberal causes, not conservative ones. And there is an emerging gender gap between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, so large, in fact, that it will be driving campaign tactics and overall strategy for the next 6 months. Sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy our podcast. Here I am with some of my favorite people again. This time, we've got Hadass Gold sitting in for Eli Stokols.
Hello.
Got Ken Vogel.
Hey.
And our senior politics editor, Charlie Mattesian.
Hi, Kristen.
We're going to do something different this week. We're going to actually start talking about Bernie Sanders instead of Donald Trump first. Bernie Sanders has had one heck of a week coming out of Nevada, where his supporters are really quite angry about the state of the race, about how the Democratic Party establishment has already anointed Hillary Clinton, about the fact that he has an enormous vote tally and is already essentially mathematically eliminated from being the nominee. The Democratic establishment has responded to that by frankly rallying around Hillary Clinton and sort of wagging their finger at Bernie Sanders and saying, get your people in line. And this is an outrage that they would think to boo Hillary Clinton supporters gathered to talk to other fellow Democrats in Nevada. So Charlie, tell us a little bit about this Democratic crackup and what it means for the race.
Well, I think what's important to keep in mind is the point you made, that Bernie Sanders is not operating from a position of weakness. Yes, he's not going to win the nomination, and yes, he faces a huge delegate deficit, but he is in the strongest position, I think, arguably, and probably has more bargaining power than any runner-up in recent Democratic primary history. He's somebody who could end up winning more than half of the states. By the end of the primary, he will have won millions of votes. He will have won more than 40%. It's not quite clear how high it will be, but more than 40% of the vote in the primaries. So he's not somebody who is coming to the table with nothing. And I think that there's a tremendous amount of frustration in his camp and among his supporters that he's not getting the appropriate amount of respect for that. And, you know, I would argue that he's got a pretty good case there. But what's interesting here is I don't think their argument is so much with the Clinton campaign, but the argument is with the Democratic Party apparatus, whether you're talking about it at the state level or at the national level. And I think that's really what this rift is about right now. I mean, it really hasn't surrounded Hillary Clinton's campaign or what they're doing. It is around the periphery of it. It's how the Nevada chair ran her convention. It is how the debates went down and what role Debbie Wasserman Schultz played it. It's how the representation on the standing committees at the convention have been allocated by the DNC. It's those sorts of things that are driving this rift right now.
Yeah, that's a great point, Charlie. And it really gets at the distinction between this race and the 2008 Democratic primary, when people were so concerned that the party would not be able to come together. During that primary, the dissent and the real nastiness extended all the way up to the candidates themselves, the candidates and their campaigns, and it started a lot earlier than this, and it stayed nasty all the way through. I remember specifically an event in Ohio, in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the run-up to the Ohio primary in 2008, February of 2008. I remember it because I overslept, and I missed the Secret Service sweep, and so I had to drive to this event to get in and get through the perimeter, and it was kind of a pain in the butt. But I got there just in time. After the event, Hillary Clinton held a press conference with Ted Strickland, governor of Ohio, by her side, and went after Barack Obama for some campaign mailers that his campaign had been distributing in the state, and she said famously, "Shame on you, Barack Obama," wagging her finger. That was in February, and that tone persisted almost all the way through June, even as Hillary Clinton was, as Bernie Sanders now is, mathematically eliminated. And so it was, I think, much nastier, and nonetheless, they ended up coming together. So I do think that there is more than a glimmer of hope for Democrats, even as things appear to be hopelessly divided between Sanders supporters and Clinton's right now that they will be able to forge a path forward together and get that unity.
You know, I just wonder who cares, right? I mean, it's, where are we? Are we in May? We're in May, right? Okay, so we are just a couple weeks away from the California primary. And a few weeks after that, we're going to be at the July convention. And then Bernie Sanders will be no more. So are we talking about this because we're desperate for something to talk about?
No.
Because we're Politico, or does it matter?
I think it matters. And I would disagree that the vitriol between the two parties on the Democratic side was maybe worse in 2008, because I would say that the Sanders supporters now are much different than what the Obama or Clinton supporters were like in 2008. Wouldn't you argue that a lot of Sanders supporters don't necessarily identify even with the Democratic Party, which was part of the issue in Nevada, wasn't it, that so many of them hadn't even the unseated delegates hadn't registered as Democrats properly in time, so they weren't like longstanding members of the party. And yes, Obama, I think, brought in a lot of new voters, but I think that the same thing that you see with Trump supporters, where they don't even consider themselves part of a political party establishment. They consider themselves Sanders voters or Trump voters.
I mean, in 2008, it was Obama who was bringing the new people to the process, and so he was going to win, and those people were going to stay inside the party as a result of him. I do think that there is something to be said for this idea that because Sanders is bringing new people to the process, if he, as he likely will, lose, then it may be difficult to keep those people on board. That said, I think that once those people sort of activate and mobilize and get involved, they're involved now, and they see the prospect of a President Donald Trump. That's going to be pretty compelling motivation. I mean, in 2008, the Hillary Clinton supporters who famously said PUMA, which stood for Party Unity My Ass, they ended up getting on board with Obama because they were so scared of John McCain. That's John McCain. He's basically a Democrat now. I mean, compared to, like, if you shift the standards. And so I think that Donald Trump will end up motivating a lot of these people to stay involved. And some of this idea that they would somehow defect entirely is a little overstated.
I think there are two important distinctions to make between 2016 and 2008. First, in 2008, the animosity was between the candidates and the campaigns. In 2016, the animosity is between factions within the party. And
that's, I think, a good point.
It's far less personal than it was between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. The other important thing to keep in mind is the position that the second place runner-ups find themselves in. In 2008, Hillary Clinton was in a very different position than Bernie Sanders. She was a creature of the party who respected the party, who, along with her husband, had ascended all of the ladders of the party to get to the position they were in. She had power bases that she had to speak to and be accountable to, whether you're talking about, you know, Wall Street money or other financial centers that could lean on her. She also had to think about her future, the fact that how she left the race would affect her ability to become the nominee in the future. Bernie Sanders is totally different. There's no one who can call him. There is no big donor that can call him up and say,
"He's not going to run again."
Bernie, time to pull the plug. He's 74 years old. Exactly. He's not going to run again. And here's the other thing. He's not a Democrat. He did not come through the party process. And it's already pretty obvious that, and we've reported this, that in the beginning, he wasn't even sure he was going to run as a Democrat. So he owes nothing to anyone in that party. And it's clear from the way he operated in Vermont that he didn't even get along with the Vermont Democratic Party. So there are very different circumstances in the two races.
But does he want his legacy to be that he was the guy who so weakened Hillary Clinton that it created a President Donald Trump? But, I mean, I think that's a consideration.
Yes, but I don't think he sees himself in Nader territory yet. I think what we've seen from him in the past is he said he's very cognizant of the possibility that he could be Nader and doesn't want that to happen at all. But I think the way he looks at it right now is he sees general election polls where he's competitive. He's done pretty well. And he thinks that at the end of the day, nothing is so broken that it can't be repaired in time for the general election.
Well, I mean, the question he's got to be asking himself is, where in the calendar does he have his greatest point of leverage, right? If he drops out now, does he have a greater ability to influence who she picks as the vice president, to influence what policy positions she stakes out before she gets into a general, where she will be naturally pulled toward the middle?
I think that for Bernie Sanders, he also keep in mind how his supporters would react if he was to drop out now. Why drop out when you're winning? And that... when I personally believe that he's going to drop out as the very last moment that he can right before conventions. But I honestly think there's going to be a huge problem with the Bernie Sanders supporters coming around to support Hillary Clinton. And I don't think it's going to be as easy that either Bernie Sanders thinks or any of the other Democrats think, and that's going to be a huge...
But what does he want? Charlie, what does he want?
He wants a movement.
I don't buy that.
He wants to affect the policy platform, number one. I think that's really important. I think he wants to play a role probably similar to Elizabeth Warren in reshaping that party and giving progressives a much stronger voice in what could you want there? I mean, you're going to want the policy platform. You're going to want a different kind of conversation on the issues that matter to him, whether it's Wall Street or fracking, climate change, all of those things.
Campaign finance reform,
all of those things. He wants to change the entire course of the debate in the Republican Party on that. And as Hadass said, if you stay in past California, roll up some great numbers in California and some of the other states on June 7th, all of a sudden, he's coming in with some, pretty muscular credentials.
Yeah, but he's lost all his goodwill with the candidate who will decide those issues.
And well, in some ways, he's already had that impact on those issues. The idea that he just wants it enshrined in the Democratic Party's platform at the convention. I mean, I guess there's something to be said for that. But it's like you've already made your impact, man, and now he's sort of paving the way to, as you said, Nader territory.
Well, now we're also starting to see how he's affecting the party as a whole. I mean, the shade being thrown by Debbie Wasserman Schultz that Jeff Weaver said, and just like you're really starting to see all of this tension come out. I mean, how they've been planning the debates has just been insane about how the Sanders campaign won't even talk to the DNC. I mean, when the Sanders campaign accepted the Fox News debate this week, I found out that the DNC only found out about that because the Sanders campaign sent them an email saying, oh, by the way, in 5 seconds, we're releasing a statement that we've accepted the Fox News debate, when the DNC really should be the ones that are kind of coordinating everything. And instead, the DNC is just like stepping in at the last second to be like, we sanction this, you're okay.
God, if you are Bernie Sanders, how are you preparing for that debate? Are you going in there trying to take her down another notch when you know that she's going up against somebody who has already been named the nominee? Or do you go in there trying to find a way to reach consensus?
I think you just go in there, if you're Bernie Sanders camp, let Bernie be Bernie. I mean, I've never really understood the criticism of Bernie Sanders that he's been really overly harsh on Hillary Clinton. He hasn't, despite all the squawking. I mean, it's really been a patty cake election between those two. He hasn't hit her that hard compared to what you've seen in past Democratic primaries or compared to what you saw on the Republican side.
That's
and
true.
I don't think he's going to change direction in any way at all. What's great, though, about Hadass's point in terms of how the DNC was cut out of the loop there is, if you're Bernie Sanders' campaign, that is a smart move. I thought that was pretty clever, because why would you trust the DNC if you're Bernie Sanders when you think of all of the ways that you feel, all of your grievances, all the ways you feel that they've had their fingers on the scale from the start, whether you're talking about the fundraising agreements, whether you're talking about the debate schedule, so many reasons for them to be pissed off at the DNC.
The Bernie Sanders camp is not the only aggravated party this week. We've got a whole host of conservatives throughout America who are pretty pissed off about Facebook and the idea that trending topics lane of the website is actually curated, right? And curated in a way that lifts up liberal topics and pushes down conservative topics. Hadass, tell us about the furor.
So this all started from a Gizmodo story, I believe about a week ago, where they reported, talking to anonymous former Facebook staffers, where they said that within the group, they would often discredit conservative news outlets by just not linking to them in this trending box, which is actually a pretty minor part of Facebook. But what this whole event has really done, it's the tipping point to how a lot of conservatives feel social media treats them in general, which is they feel that social media is in Silicon Valley and is just it's just a bunch of liberals. And they have reason to believe that because people like Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, will say things and do things that are of a very liberal point of view. So after this Gizmodo story, everybody reacted. The RNC gave a statement, put out a petition. Facebook very quickly did PR damage control and invited a list of about 12 conservative/Republican activists or journalists or people who have worked in digital spheres out to Facebook headquarters and treated them to a jam-packed day of all of their top people gave them a tour of the campus and really tried to mend the fences a little bit, sweeten the deal a little bit, say, look, we're putting Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, and Peter Thiel in front of you for 90 minutes.
Breitbart called this patting conservatives on the head.
Yes, and some
Do they
outlets.
Get free snacks? When I bring people in who are pissed off at Politico for a tour, I always take them upstairs to our brand spanking new cafeteria and show them our free snacks urge them to help themselves.
They got a great tour. They were taken to the roof. They were given an Oculus virtual reality test drive. Somebody told me that Barry Bennett of the Trump campaign was a huge fan and did the hiking version. Everyone that I talked to from the meeting came away with it feeling positive. They said that they felt like they understood where they were coming from and recognized that if they were to give off the impression that they didn't treat conservatives fairly, they'd lose a huge and important share of people who use Facebook. And that's not what Facebook wants to do. However, they did express that they wanted more ideological diversity at Facebook.
Yeah, and that's all well and good. But like this idea that they would lose the conservatives, really, where are they going to go? I mean, the Facebook is really the only game in town for that type of social media. But
make your own Facebook, Ken.
Right. It raises this larger point to me, and it kind of sticks in my craw a little bit that you have these conservatives who, whether it's Hollywood and the movies or the media or social media and Facebook, they raise these concerns about somehow being treated unfairly. And their suggestion here, like ultimately, is like there should be some kind of like government action to regulate Facebook, which is so anathema to conservative free market principles. Like really, if you were a true free market purist, you would say in all these cases exactly what you just said. We don't like Facebook. We're going to make our own Facebook. We don't like Hollywood movies. We're going to make our own studio. We don't like the media. We're going to make our own media outlets. In fact, on the media side, they have started to with some success. So
success.
Yeah, great time. Look at Independent Journal, for instance. And so, yeah, I mean, that would be the free market answer. Go make your own Facebook.
Right.
Instead, you have this hand-wringing and complaining and finger-pointing and suggestions of government regulation, which is not at all what conservatism is about.
And honestly, the impression I got from a lot of the people who went to this is that they recognized that these reports were, while even if, you know, if they were true or anything, they might have been overblown in a way, and that the reaction that they were attending this meeting because they were invited, but also because it's almost to like tamp down their readers and supporters, be like, look, we're getting in, we're in the Facebook headquarters, we're here, we're taking action, when really they kind of knew that like this doesn't really matter.
Well, and my goodness, it's not like the IRS thing, right? No. It's a completely different ballgame.
Right. But I mean, and what actually matters more, if you're looking at the technical aspect of it, that trending box, half the people who probably read the stories didn't even realize the trending box existed. What's much more important is the algorithm for the news feed. However, what the fear for the conservatives is that this type of sensibility would eventually make its way into news feed. But honestly, and this is what some of the conservatives brought up who went, they said Facebook wants the same things we want, which is often less government intrusion. And to be honest, they're a private company. They can do whatever the heck they want. But if they want to keep our audiences, they're going to have to do this big show, which they did. And a lot of them believe that now it's going to calm down a little bit. This is going to be like a 2-week story.
And of course, there is this larger point, which is that Facebook, just by virtue of its dominance, does have like a great deal of cultural currency and cultural influence and economic influence. And we see that in the media where all, you know, media outlets are making deals to post their content straight to Facebook. And it's a platform that in some ways makes it difficult for media outlets, sort of perpetuates this trend in which media outlets have had trouble adopting to the digital, the new like digital reality.
Well, let's bring this back home for a second and talk about the political implications, because Facebook is incredibly relevant to the campaigns. If we've seen anything in 2016 that's different from previous cycles, it's the incredible facility of the campaigns to reach very targeted voter groups, right? So the idea that conservatives would ever pull away from Facebook is frankly nonsense because the campaigns are so adept at reaching their voters in that platform. These are people who use Facebook aggressively, just like liberals do. And all of the Republican campaigns went after their voters in that forum.
And spent a lot of money on Facebook
ads.
Tons
of money. Not as much money as I would think, right? Because it's still relatively cheap, but a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, to your point, Kristen, the Tea Party was basically organized on Facebook.
That's right.
Right. And so it is, there is an open platform type of element to it. What the beef is about some of the more curated stuff, but that doesn't diminish the usefulness of it for organizers of all stripes. I mean, you see, like,
it's by far the most important platform for this group of people, right? We talk about Twitter here, and are you on Twitter aggressively? It really only matters in the media community, right? Or in the politics and politicians, the Washington community, right? People in the real world don't use Twitter way that we do. They use Facebook.
And that explains why the right, and this is where I'm on the other side of it, Ken. I mean, I think conservatives have every right to be really angry about this for the very reasons that Christian just laid out. I mean, I think, you know, aside from the incredible power of that platform, Facebook, as I see it, has always promoted itself as a platform devoted to transparency and open discussion. And imagine if you're a conservative and one day you wake up that's not really the case, that this is a distorted market, that you did not know in any way or were led to believe otherwise, that they were cooking, they were putting their finger on the scales.
So what is the solution to that, though? Is it government regulation, which, again, in my contention, it completely flies in the face of conservatism? Or is it free market competition, where you don't like it, take your business elsewhere and go find your own social or create your own social media platform?
I don't think you'd find a ton of Republicans or conservatives calling for government regulation here. There were a couple voices out there saying that, but I think really they just wanted to.
Well, they're doing congressional questionings.
That's not the same as congressional hearings is just doing the perp walk.
Right.
You know, I mean, congressional hearings is just your opportunity to beat the crap out of the people that you're angry with. That's a very different thing than actually calling for regulation.
But does it not give the impression of the government getting involved in a private enterprise's work?
No, there are congressional hearings about lots of different things, you know, without actually calling for increased government regulation.
I mean, I would agree with Hadass a little bit. It's a threat of government regulation that makes the hearings, that attracts attention to the hearings and makes them what they are. I mean, it's like, you know, the steroid hearings in Major League Baseball. That's a regulated monopoly. And in fact, bringing the Roger Clemens before Congress to ask him about steroid use, the logical conclusion of that is government regulation. Now, it didn't happen, but it's not to say it couldn't. And I think that's why that's why these hearings like carry such weight with Facebook. Who knows? I mean, maybe it is a monopoly, and maybe it should be regulated as such. But I would just contend that is not really that kind of flies in the face of a conservative view of how the free market should function.
And I would say conservatives opposed to regulation should be careful here, because there's a lot of talk about the internet in general being considered a public utility, right? Which opens it up to government regulation. And when you start talking about a public utility like the internet and combine that with monopolistic practices like Facebook might be accused of, you're opening up a can of worms that you're really going to regret if you are a conservative opposed to regulation.
And in fact, the FEC, which has exempted most internet communication from federal election laws, the former chairman of the FEC, Ann Revell, suggested reopening the internet, doing a rulemaking on some internet communication, and the wrath of hate that she received from conservatives. Our former colleague Dave Leventhal is now at the Center for Public Integrity. Did a story, I think he used FOIA to essentially gain access to her inbox, all the comments that were being sent to her, just some vicious stuff about shutting down free speech. So you see there sort of the opposite pull from conservatives against this type of regulation.
Charlie, I think we're wrong.
I do. I would just be careful about equating hearings with a call for increased regulation. I mean, congressional hearings are Washington's preferred form of political theater. They're for fact-finding. They're for peacocking by little-known members of Congress. I mean, when you start hearing conservatives actually call for maybe the Justice Department should take a look at this, maybe there are any antitrust implications, things like that, then the debate begins to change, I think.
All right, let's bring Scott Bland into this conversation. Scott, welcome again, our editor from Campaign Pro.
Thanks for having me.
So this week we saw a number of very interesting stories, frankly revolving around the campaign's efforts to attract women to their cause. Early this week, we had the New York Times with an incredible story, frankly, about how Donald Trump treats women in his orbit. Now, the Trump campaign and some of the women who were spoken with by the New York Times reporters have dismissed this reporting as not fully accurate, and in some cases, you know, quite inaccurate. But the story was an important one. In this story, the New York Times reporters talked to 50 women who recounted ways that they were treated by Donald Trump, demeaning ways that they were treated by Donald Trump. What can you tell us, Scott, in looking at all of the stories we've seen this week, starting with the New York Times, leading all the way up to Donald Trump making an accusation that Bill Clinton is a rapist? What does this tell us about what the campaigns are doing to attract women voters to their own campaign and drive women away from the opponent?
It tells us that it's the central question of the campaign, and you could see that in the Priorities USA ads released earlier this week, which were targeted, their first TV ads for the Clinton Super PAC of 2016, targeted directly at women, using past quotes from Donald Trump, on women, on abortion. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the recent polls, we pulled five or six recent polls from the online aggregators, and whether Trump is leading in one recent Fox poll or Clinton is leading in the other ones, the gender gap is enormous. There's a 22-point average gender gap in these polls, and what that means, it's the difference between how well Trump, the Republican, is doing among men, how much he's leading with men, and how much Clinton is leading among women. 22-point gap. For context, in 2014, exit polls showed the largest gender gap in the last 20 years, and that was 20 points. So already the polls are showing an even bigger gap in how men view Trump and how women view Clinton than we saw in the largest such gap in an election in the last 20 years.
Charlie, what does this tell you about what the campaign is doing? How are they viewing this inside?
Well, I think they are beginning to recognize that this is the Mars versus Venus election, but I think the real concern is what this opens the door to. Once you start that discussion, in the past, Republicans have been on the defensive on gender gap issue. I mean, it's so familiar. We've been seeing it in elections for decades. But what's different now is that Trump has signaled that he's opened the door to throwing out everything from Bill Clinton's closet, whether it's Juanita Broderick, whether it's charges going back decades. And all of a sudden, that's an X factor in the election that I don't think the Clinton campaign or any campaign really would know how to deal with something like that once you get that National Enquirer element.
It seems to me that what Donald Trump is trying to do is maybe not pull women to him, but make sure women don't vote for Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, it seems to be that he's going to spend the general election going after Bill Clinton and calling Hillary Clinton, and we're already seeing it, an enabler, in the belief that other women will look at that and see some hint of truth. It's like the one thing that Donald Trump is really, really good at is finding that little thing. It's like a bully's ability to find that little point of weakness and exploit it. And he's found that with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. No, Ken?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Kristen. And it ties in with what Charlie was saying, that we're seeing an effort to sort of stretch the bounds of what is acceptable political discourse, bringing in, Charlie alludes to the National Enquirer, but it's not just the National Enquirer. It's Roger Stone, the longtime Donald Trump confidant, who has written a book, The Clinton's War on Women, that gets into some of this just sensational, unproven stuff. Trump has showed a willingness to go there. He's denied that he is pulling directly from that book, but at other times he has referred to the book, and certainly Roger Stone has planted the idea that he is feeding Donald Trump this stuff. Let's not forget, Roger Stone is a guy who also wrote a book about the man who killed Kennedy. Yes, that would be LBJ. LBJ and Roger Stone telling was responsible for 9 murders, including the greatest crime of the 20th century, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So you can kind of see where this might be headed if Roger Stone is in fact the guy who is advising either directly or indirectly Donald Trump on how to take on the Clintons.
But you know what? The fact is this stuff resonates. It resonates with people in a real and meaningful way, and it resonates with women. When you accuse Hillary Clinton of enabling the bad behavior of her husband, and not just the bad behavior, the embarrassing stuff, but stuff that might have actually damaged other women, that is stuff that speaks to female voters in America. Am I wrong about this?
I think you're right, and I think that it's sort of something that has dogged her from the beginning. I think there is also an argument to be made, however, that some of the behavior of her husband has helped her to some extent, that women feel sorry for her, but there's a fine line between seeing her as sort of a blameless victim in this and someone who is, as Donald Trump has suggested, an enabler.
I'd argue that it also burnishes Trump's brand because, think about it, he is speaking truth to two of the most powerful people in the world. Who says that kind of stuff to the Clintons? Somebody like Donald Trump, who is not afraid of anyone. It advances the notion that he will say anything, that he's tough, that he's authentic, and that he's not afraid of anyone. And I think that there are a lot of people on the right that feel that Bill Clinton got a pass for some of his behavior. And now that sort of society's mores have changed over the last couple decades, introducing this new X element in terms of how some of the how some of his transgressions were handled before, how the Clinton operation treated some of those women. I think we could have a very different debate now than we did before, and it could be very damaging.
Absolutely, Charlie. And the debate is both in the figurative sense as to what is happening in the media. And, of course, we see a media today that is so much more fractured and democratized, I guess would be the sort of positive way to put it, than it was in the 1990s when there was a conservative media that was going after some of these Clinton charges, that was waging the Clinton wars, but was really siloed and isolated from the rest of the media. Now, that's not the case. It's all very integrated in a big cacophonous mess. So there's that media debate and air quotes. And then there are actual debates where Trump will be on stage with Hillary Clinton being able to make some of these charges directly. I think that's going to be explosive.
It's going to be ugly. Scott, talk to us a little bit about how these allegations around Bill Clinton's behavior, however many years ago it was, how that affects voters. What are you seeing in the polling on that?
Yeah, basically, we're not seeing anything about it yet, right? Clinton still does very well with women, as you would expect a Democratic presidential nominee to do, as you would expect a female Democratic presidential nominee to do. If you look at the last few polls, Fox, which had Clinton trailing in the first major national poll in a very long time, trailing Trump, had Clinton beating Trump by 14 points among women. Now, Trump led because he had an even bigger lead among men, 22 points. And so, you know, we'll have to take some time and see if that's replicated in more polls and kind of what happens as the Democratic primary closes out and what happens in the next few weeks. But even in the one poll that showed Donald Trump winning, Clinton is just crushing it with women.
All right, let's leave it there. Thank you, Scott Bland.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hadass Gold.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken Vogel.
Fun time as always.
And Charlie Mattesian.
Thanks, Kristen.
That's it for us. Thank you. If you like what you heard, go and search us on iTunes and Stitcher. Look for 2016 Nerdcast. Rate us and subscribe.